This is an ABC podcast.
Kasalilie, talohani and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie Dubow, and coming up on the show, will Australia's Minister for Climate Change drum up enough support in the Pacific to help with their bid to host COP31? Visa-free travel has the backing of many Pacific leaders. And what is a funerary and why is it taking up space in a New York museum? We'll find out more on that story and others shortly. But before we begin, we'd like to give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, paying respects to elders past and present. I say malo apito. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. In Fiji today, they'll see the most important part of a series of traditional symbolic rituals to install one of the country's paramount chiefs. Later this morning, Bratu Te Vita Aluilam Gemba Mara will become Tui Na Yau and Sauni Vanua o Lau, the High Chief of the Lau Islands. The positions have been vacant since his father, Fiji's first Prime Minister, Ratu Sirkamisese Mara, died 20 years ago. Among the dignitaries in Lau to witness the historic occasion are Tonga's King Tupou VI and New Zealand's Māori Queen Te Ariki Kuini Ngā Waihono I Te Pō. The installation of a high chief is more than just tradition. It's a sacred encounter between culture and faith. Christian rituals now form part of the ceremony, reflecting how Indigenous Fijian identity has evolved alongside Western influences. Also, there is Catholic Archbishop Peter Lloyd-Chong, who says merging Indigenous and Christian symbols can renew both cultural identity and spiritual purpose. Here he is, speaking to our reporter, Lile Mowono.
It's an interesting time. It's a time to reflect on how we can be better communicators of the Christian message by bringing together a dialogue between the Christian symbols and the local symbols and to, make this symbol, which is very important to the indigenous Fijian culture, maintain its position as a medium for God's salvation, the chiefly system, how it can help enhance, promote truth, justice, peace, and a more humanistic love.
In your times with the Turanga Tuneau, you're one of the very few people that have that kind of close contact with the chief. What kind of a message do you want to leave with him going forward as chief of Lau?
The message is in these rituals, in the Christian symbols, the rituals that the symbols that we are using is anointing with oil. That has a lot of biblical symbolisms. Kings were anointed. Jesus was anointed with the Holy Spirit. So anointing is a very biblical symbol. Then we have the placing of the Nasalani singer, which is the hat that will be placed on the Tuinayau's head. That has its own symbols. Some of these symbols, we need to explore more about it. My conversations, people are not very clear what the symbolism. They compare it to the crown, the symbol of kingship, authority. Then we have the symbol of laying on of hands, which is a more biblical Christian symbol. We lay hands on a person to communicate the outpouring of the Spirit on him. Now, in the past, indigenous Fijian rituals for the installation of a chief, Wewangunuwi is at the very important part, where he takes the first cup of bowl of Yangona that he drinks as chief. That has its own very strong symbols. We won't do that in the church, but there will be an Angona ceremony. The drinking of the cover has a very strong symbolism. That means he's taking in the Vanua. He's drinking in the Vanua. That means he becomes the custodian of the Vanua. And the Vanua is a common Polynesian view of the world. That means the people, the land, plants, living things on the land, under the water. And so, as he drinks the cup of the Yangon, the symbolism is that he becomes the custodian, he becomes the steward of the whole of creation. Now, that speaks a lot to today's environment world, the care of creation. He becomes the, you know, he embodies the whole of the Vanua and sees that the protection of the whole cosmos is in his hands. So that's a very strong, powerful symbol. Be a pity if we lost that one, you know. There is a lot of messaging going out there, especially in the today in the world where climate change and care for the environment is very important.
And that's Archbishop Peter Lloyd-Chong speaking to Lili Mavono. Pacific Beat. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, visa-free travel, it's a policy proposal many Pacific Island leaders have been pushing the Australian government to implement. And it's something that appears to be gaining public support in Australia. Whenua Whenua spoke to one advocate, Ed Kavanagh, head of foreign policy think tank at the McCall Institute in Sydney.
Basically, at the moment, we have this asymmetry between the visa relationship between Australia and the Pacific. So if you're an Australian and you want to go just about anywhere in the Pacific Islands, you're going to be let in with, you know, open arms. You're going to be welcomed in with absolutely no barriers. But of course, if it's the other way around, if you're a Pacific Islander trying to travel through Australia even or travel to Australia, often this is an incredibly onerous process to get a tourist visa or a transit visa. And this asymmetry, this conflict between the way that Australia treats Pacific Islanders coming into Australia versus the way Pacific countries treat Australians going into the Pacific, it flies in the face, in my view, of the strategic embrace that Australia is making with the region. You know, we always hear Australian leaders talk about the Pacific being family, but you don't necessarily have your mum and dad come over and ask them to fill out reams of paperwork every time they do to check that they're doing the right thing. So I think this visa dynamic is a real sore point in the relationship between Australia and the Pacific, and I think it needs to end.
Do you think it strains relations with Pacific Island nations? Do you think it undermines Australia's geopolitical competition?
I don't think it undermines the relationship, but it certainly limits the relationship. And that's the big problem. We have, over the last, say, 10, 15 years, been really trying to demonstrate to the Pacific from an Australian perspective that the partnership is genuine, that there's a deep respect between Australian governments and Pacific governments and Australian communities and Pacific communities. The reason why there is so much paperwork and so much difficulty for Pacific Islanders getting a visa into Australia, though, is because at the end of the day, I think many Australian policymakers don't trust that Pacific Islanders will do the right thing when they're in Australia. And I think that is a sore point in the relationship. I don't think that's based on any evidence. And I think it would be both symbolic and practically beneficial if the Australian government basically tore down a lot of those barriers for getting a visa to come into Australia and ultimately establish some sort of visa-free travel arrangement between Australia and Pacific Island countries.
You said practically beneficial. Could you expand on that?
Well, I'll give you an example. If you're a islander somewhere in Vanuatu or Solomon Islands that doesn't live in the capital, if you want to travel to Australia, you need to do a lot of paperwork to get a visa sorted. Now, that includes a huge cost. So if you're, say, living in Pentecost in Vanuatu, if you're living in Malaita in Solomon Islands, if you're living somewhere outside of any capital in the Pacific, if you want to come into Australia, you're almost certainly going to have to travel to your own capital city at great expense, fill out lots of paperwork, pay a lot of money. That fundamentally limits the ability of many Pacific Islanders to ever come to Australia. It makes it very hard for them to aspire to coming to Australia. And that means that the level of person-to-person relationships, people-to-people relationships between the two countries is just fundamentally constrained. So I think there's no need to have such tight visa restrictions on many Pacific Islanders. And I think fundamentally it just limits the degree of engagement that the two regions can have.
I guess one of the concerns is that visa-free travel would result in a surge of immigrants into Australia from the Pacific.
My view is that risk is completely overblown. There's a few reasons for that. One is that currently, we already have visa-free relationships with a lot of countries where a lot of those people coming into Australia do overstay their visa. Now, one of the biggest overstaying countries is the United Kingdom. So there's a lot of people here on a working holiday visa who overstay visas. A huge amount of Europeans overstay their visas. A huge amount of other Southeast Asian countries that are engaged on working holiday visas in Australia or visa-free entry as tourists also overstay their visas. Like, so this is the problem of overstaying visas already exists, and it's actually with countries that are much, much larger than, say, Tuvalu or Solomon Islands or countries where there's just not a huge amount of people actually coming to Australia in the first place. The reason why I think we should liberalise this and make it easier is that it's not a huge practical burden on Australia to say if occasionally there's a Pacific Islander overstaying their visa, they would be subject to the exact same, you know, punishments and consequences that anyone else would overstaying their visa. We already have those systems in place. And just by the reality of the economy, you know, the economic capacity of many Pacific Islanders too, while more people would come to Australia if there was easier visas, it's not like every single person in the Pacific is suddenly going to have enough money to fly to Australia tomorrow. And to immigrate and to take advantage of this. So I think the fears of overstaying are overblown, and I think they're certainly outweighed by the benefits of lowering this visa wall.
And that was McCall Institute foreign policy expert Ed Kavanagh here on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, Australia's Minister for Climate Change, Chris Bowen, is on a four-stop Pacific tour to drum up support for his government's bid to host a major global climate change conference next year. The push to host the UN conference, known as COP31, recently hit a snag when the only other contender, Turkey, refused to bow out of the race as many had expected. Australia wants to host the talks in partnership with Pacific nations, and many leaders have publicly supported the idea. So what's Chris Bowen hoping to achieve during his visits to Tuvalu, Palau, Samoa and Marshall Islands this week? Well, we can ask him ourselves because he joins us on the line now from the Marshall Islands. With that, I say good morning, Minister, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, Agnes. Thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. Well, look, as I mentioned, many Pacific leaders have already pledged support for Australia hosting COP31. I mean, what are you hoping comes out of your trip this week?
So this trip isn't primarily about our COP31 bid. Obviously, I'm updating my ministerial colleagues as I go about the state of the discussions with Turkey and the process. And the situation remains we have very, very strong support for our bid from our group, the Western Europe and Others group, which Australia is a member of, and we have the majority support in that group. But the system is meant to work on consensus, and that means the need to have ongoing discussions with Turkey. And I've been updating the ministerial colleagues about the nature of those conversations, and the Pacific remains extremely supportive of our bid, has been all the way through, and remains extremely supportive. But I'm also, while I'm here in the Pacific, pursuing bilateral partnerships on the energy transition, made good progress on that, including here in RMI and off to Palau shortly, and general update on where we're all at on our decarbonisation journey and what we can do to support each other is the general approach I've taken as Minister with my Pacific colleagues, and that certainly continues.
Well, Minister, you know, in regards to COP31, I mean, are you actually seeking these nations' help to pressure Turkey into bowing out? I mean, if so, can they help?
Well, they've already been doing that. They've already been making their views very clear to Turkey and to other nations that they want to see the COP31 in Australia in partnership with the Pacific. I mean, I couldn't have asked for more from our Pacific colleagues. They have made that very clear. They've written to Turkey. They've offered to do more when and if they can. But the situation is not like we need more support. It's not like we need other countries to come in and support us, because we have very, very strong support across the world. But we treat Turkey with respect. They've indicated they don't wish to withdraw their nomination, despite the fact, it's pretty clear we have the overwhelming bulk of support within the Western Europe and Others group. That's their right. We'll continue to talk to them about that and potential outcomes there. And we'll continue to update the Pacific on how we're going and what options we have in front of us. I've been doing that in my private meetings with my ministerial colleagues, as I do from time to time when either they come to Australia or on WhatsApp or in any other form. I keep them advised and consult with them about various options. And that's been a useful part of this trip, but it hasn't been the only part of the trip. As I said, I wouldn't see this trip as a COP31 only trip. It's been also about other things like the APET agreement I signed yesterday with Minister Lakhchon, the letter of intent to pursue that, what I'll be doing in Palau later today, supporting their transition. These have all also been very important parts of the trip.
Thank you for that, Minister. Look, and I know you're saying the trip is not just about COP31, but I would like to just stay on that topic in the sense of, but why do you think then Takea is not willing to step aside?
Well, look, I'm not going to sort of give a blow-by-blow description of my conversations with my Turkish counterpart. It's fair to say, you know, they say they are entitled, just as entitled to put their bid forward as we are, and that's true. They are entitled to do that. They have views about what they could bring to the table. We point out that the last few COPs have been in Egypt and then the UAE and then Azerbaijan, and having another COP in that part of the world in short order would probably not be in the best interests of fairness and diversity of views. There's never been a COP in the Pacific, which is the region with the most at stake, we would argue, in climate change, as and the small island developing states are really sort of split between the Pacific and the Caribbean. We think the Pacific has a huge amount to bring to the table. Australia's COP president would ensure that the Pacific's issues are front and centre of the agenda with a big spotlight on them. You won't get that in other COPs around the world. You certainly won't get that in Turkey, with all due respect. You won't get that in Brazil, nor do they claim to. That is something that can only be delivered in Australia. So that's something that we bring to the table. Of course, you know, we'll also be talking about Australia's role in the global transition, our role and our intention to become a renewable energy superpower, be able to share our thoughts on our journeys there, some of the obstacles, headwinds, opportunities that we face. We think there's something to bring to the rest of the world there. And that's the sort of message that I continue to pursue. So again, Turkey is entitled to put their bid. They're entitled to stay in as long as they feel it prudent. We'd like to see this resolved as soon as possible so we can get on with planning. Because this is a big undertaking. But we'll work with the system that we have, and we'll continue to talk to colleagues, Turkey, our Pacific colleagues, our Western Europe and other group colleagues, the whole bunch.
Yeah, Minister, but do you think Turkey is looking for something in return if they were to withdraw from this race?
Well, again, I'm not going to go into the blow-by-blow descriptions of my conversations with him. We've clearly indicated to them an outcome would be good, which they are happy with and we are happy with. Oh, we haven't been able to reach that outcome yet. You know, essentially the COP needs to be hosted in Australia. Australia will be the COP president in close consultation with the Pacific. We want to see all that happen. Again, we'll keep talking to them and hope for an outcome quite soon. I've kept my Pacific ministerial colleagues apprised as best I can of the nature of those conversations, the sorts of things that are being discussed. They're diplomatic conversations. They're not sort of public conversations. But, you know, the Pacific ministers deserve to know where we're all up to. Of course, that's been an element of my discussions on this trip, but not the only element, far from it.
Yeah, the thing is also, you know, as you chase this bid, Minister, I know a lot of people would want to know, I mean, and this is the reality too, is what happens, though, if there is no consensus reached ahead or even during COP30 that is going to be in Belém in November? What will happen then?
Well, there's a process. I mean, I very much hope we don't get to that. If the two countries can't resolve it, there are options available. And there are options which should involve the COP being held in Germany. There's options, which is the host of the UNFCCC. There's options which should involve, you know, ballot processes. We're trying to avoid all that. But we're also trying to get the COP to come to Australia for the best interests of Australia, the best interests of the Pacific, and we think the best interests of the world.
And that's it. If you do secure the bid, Minister, what role will Pacific nations play, I suppose, in terms of co-hosting this event? Like, will any of these meetings be physically held in the Pacific?
Well, there's options there, which I'll talk to, have been talking to the Pacific ministers about for some time. You know, I've had two Talanoas with the Pacific ministers over the last 2 years. We'll have another one later this year where we have discussed some of those options. It's very hard, though, to lock that in until we've won the bid. There's pre-COP, there's other elements to the COP, there's all sorts of options, there's high-level champions, there's all sorts of things that the Pacific, I want to see the Pacific front and centre in this COP that I've been talking to my Pacific ministerial counterparts. And if we do lock this bid down, we can then proceed with those conversations, lock that in and have some firm agreements.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for that, Minister. Look, I just want to step aside and maybe ask, Minister, did you get to watch the Origin decider last night?
I didn't, I'm afraid. I was in my hotel room in the Marshall Islands doing other things. I didn't get to see the State of Origin, but I have been briefed on it this morning by my delegation.
Appreciate your time this morning, Minister. Thank you so much for coming through and speaking to us and enjoying the rest of your trip there.
Well, Agnes, I look forward to speaking to you in the future, hopefully as the host of COP31, because there's so much to do. But it's also, as I've stressed, other things that we're getting on with. An important agreement yesterday with RMI, another big investment this afternoon with Palau to help with their energy transition, because we've got to help the Pacific nations with their energy systems as well. Australia's certainly front and centre of doing that.
Thank you again, Minister. Appreciate your time this morning.
Good on you, Agnes. Good on you. Cheers in. Ta-da.
Thank you. That is Australia's Minister for Climate Change, Chris Bowen, here on Pacific Beat. Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, it is that time when we head around the region to get the latest headlines brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, who's in the studio with me this morning. Good morning. How are you going?
I mean, a day's ever good after a Game 3 Origin when you're a New South Wales supporter. Yes. I don't think they ever are. In my whole 37 years of existence, it's
Yeah. We don't need to talk about it this morning. But hey, what we do need to talk about is some of the stories that are happening in the region. This one here is authorities are calling for reform after a rampaging mob stormed through central Port Moresby on Tuesday. What happened there?
Yeah, very concerning this one, Aggie. So several areas of the Port Moresby CBD descended into chaos a couple of days ago after riots travelling in 21 public transport DMVs launched a spree of coordinated attacks across the city. They were believed to be young people or youths, believed to be from the Highlands. And according to the Post Courier, they may have been acting in retaliation after the alleged stabbing of a bus crew member. Wow. Witnesses say they were carrying weapons and assaulting just people at random on the street. They were grabbing bags. One car was hijacked. There was even allegedly the attempted abduction of not one but two schoolgirls, one of which who was wearing uniform. Police, meanwhile, were somewhat powerless to stop it all as well and could really only hold back crowds of furious people and just try and keep people out of the way. The only good news is Aggie, is that miraculously nobody was killed.
Thank goodness. But look, how have the authorities responded to all of this?
Yeah, look, very vocally, not surprisingly. Police and leaders have condemned, obviously, the incident. An investigation is underway into finding those responsible. Governor Powers Parkop took to Facebook and actually told the Road Traffic Authority to immediately suspend all the operating licences of those PMVs involved. He's even called for a review into the RTA's role in sort of managing public transport in Port Moresby. So, yeah, they've responded very strongly, and he basically just says this incident must be a turning point because it's publicity like this they probably can't afford, you know, particularly with the NRL coming in a couple of years.
Okay, well, thank you for that story. We head to Guam because their stray dog population has reached breaking point. What does that mean?
Yeah, so based off data from earlier this year, there is now an estimated 60,000 free-roaming dogs in Guam, which is nearly a third of the island's population. So it's a number that's more than doubled since 2014, when the numbers were last crunched, and so much so that Guam's Animal Authority received over 1,000 complaints last year alone. A quarter of them were related to animal bites and aggression. And what's worse is Guam only has 3 animal control officers and 1 truck to catch stray animals with. So, yeah, they're very much operating behind the eight ball. And when they do manage to pick up strays, there's really nowhere to put them. Guam only has 1 shelter, which has more than 5,000 animals currently in it, and only 400 of them were adopted last year.
Well, I have to ask, what's the solution then?
Yeah, it's a great question. They are throwing everything at it. Guam's Animal Authority has created a dog population management task force, which takes in agencies, vets, scholars, even military personnel to try and, you know, come up with ways to fix this issue. They've been trying to replicate initiatives carried out elsewhere in the world without much success so far. One policy being, what they've developed is what's called a trap, neuter, and release program, where free-roaming dogs and cats are basically caught, sterilized, vaccinated, then re-released back to where they were caught. That's worked elsewhere in the world. But according to other reports as well, there's not much happening at a grassroots level. So, yeah. You know, local councils, things like that. So hopefully they can turn it around.
Okay. Well, finally, another Queensland miracle in the state of origin last night. Let's take a listen.
Spiral pass, granted to Eden, now Munster, out in front, Shibasaki gives it to Coates. Queensland are going to open the try scoring. At this magnitude, but it mightn't be that easy. Oh, it's play on. Hammer back to Dearden. Dearden sprints away to score. The New South Wales players stopped. They thought it was a lost ball. Harry tries to burrow. Six more tackles. Surely New South Wales can't hold him out. He's over for a try. Oh, Luo was a sitting duck. Cleary got it. They go wide. The pass is stick. Stephen Crichton sprints for the corner. Crichton's going to get it. And maybe this is the start the fans were waiting for. They're game on. Third tackle on this refresh set. New South Wales are hardly hanging on here. The Queensland team of 2025 have captured a victory to stand alongside any in Origin's 45-year history.
I don't know what to say about that.
I liked how you were cheering along while listening to that, Aggie, even though we both,
it was one for Crichton.
We both knew the result. Yeah, Crichton. It was probably one of the very few highlights in the match if you're a New South Wales supporter.
Yes.
But look, to be honest, at this point, I kind of feel like it's wrong to even call it a Queensland miracle. It's a Queensland tradition at this point. You know, every time the Blues seem to be on the brink of a dynasty, Queensland will just pull one out from nowhere, and that's exactly what happened again last night. 24-12, two tries to Dom Dearden, as well as one to Harry Grant. PNG international Xavier Coates, he crossed first. As we just spoke of, good Pacific turnout for New South Wales, with Crichton and To'o both going over, not for the first time this series. In some ways, though, I can't blame New South Wales too much, just given that there were just so many narratives that felt like were going Queensland's way last night. One of them tragic, obviously, with the tragic passing of Cam Munster's father, but obviously you had Papali'i's return as well. It just seemed like there was too much bad karma for New South Wales to overcome, and the stage was set for I worried a Blues capitulation, and just that's exactly what's what's happened. So
unfortunate Blues, but we are still loyal supporters. But yes, that has been your news wrap here on Pacific Beat. Kyle, as always, Vinaka, thank you for bringing that to us here on Pacific Beat.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground having conversations and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Malo e tau mai bumbungini. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, in a country that is yet to be connected by road, aviation is a crucial part of everyday life in Papua New Guinea. It's a growing sector, bolstered by a partnership with the Australian Defence Force, which is supporting PNG defence personnel to achieve their commercial pilot's licence. Lucy Cooper filed the story.
A lifelong dream fulfilled.
I had a dream to be in the aviation field since before joining the military. So to be able to do that today was an achievement. And I guess it's more or less my childhood dream to be in the field of aviation, which got me through to where I am today.
That's Lieutenant Hayden Chan of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force. At a ceremony at the Royal Australian Air Force Base in Townsville, Lieutenant Chan graduated, having achieved his commercial pilot's license from the National Aviation Academy.
The course itself involves theory and practical phase, so we had to do the theory part of it, which was pass CASA, which is Civil Aviation Safety in Australia standards, the exams that they set out for us, a total of 7 exams on the theory side of the house. After we do that, then we do the practical flying and then the actual flight test itself.
It's all part of the PNGDF pilot training continuum, which is supported by the Australian Defence Force.
A lot of time and effort has been put into studies, and there's some barriers that we really had to get over, and some of which are basically the language barrier. And, you know, English is not our first language, but some of the terms in the English language is different to how we understand it back home. Or on the course, particularly for myself, I'd say that. So I feel relieved to have put in the hard work and to get where I am today.
It's not easy. There were three members of the PNGDF at the start of the course. By the end, Lieutenant Chan was the only one to complete it, having spent the last 6 months on his own.
It's been very intense, especially with some of the sacrifices that we've made along the course to get this far. It's pretty much hard work and commitment and all the good stuff that goes into the achievement itself. My family has had to make certain sacrifices, and I can't repay them for what they've done to let me come and do the course. And this achievement is not only my achievement, but it's an achievement for them as well.
Colonel Siale Francis Diro, the Defence Advisor to Australia with the PNG High Commission, was in Townsville for the ceremony.
It was a very tough course, and as expected, the standards were very high. He was required to step outside of his comfort zone, that's particularly intellectually. Air is a precision industry. I'm army. So I can only imagine just how precise you have to be, and the learning that you have to undertake to achieve that level of precision. And he has accomplished that. He has a couple more other things to do before he returns home to Papua New Guinea. But he's done extremely well. He started off as, like myself, as an infantry officer with our 2nd Battalion at Moen Barracks in Wewak, and eventually moved on to his career aspiration to become a pilot.
He says the aviation sector is vital to Papua New Guinea.
Our government, through the Connect PNG program, trying its best to connect the country by road. At the moment, the country hasn't reached that stage yet. So for decades, air capability has been critical to national development, and it'll continue to be so until, much of the country, or most of the country, is connected by road. So air capability is critical. All of these incremental achievements by our members through the partnership that we have with the Australian Defence Force are tremendously valuable. They add value to our ability to serve our people and provide military support, albeit aviation, to our government. So the program that Hayden is on and his achievement is extremely important to our development and indeed the way that we need to move forward.
For Lieutenant Chan's family in Rabaul, East New Britain, it was a momentous occasion.
Every child's achievement is parents' great achievement as well, and they are proud of my achievement today. They are happy at home, and they will be celebrating with a meal probably at lunchtime or something, so it feels good that my achievement is not only celebrated here but also back at home.
He's hoping to enter a role in training, inspired by his own experience, to mentor aspiring PNG pilots.
Huge sigh of relief that it's now over and done with. The course that I initially came here to do, it's now over and done with, and it's starting to set in that that qualification has already been achieved, and looking forward to going back and giving that service to the people back home.
And that's Lieutenant Hayden Chan of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force, ending that story from Lucy Cooper. Now, if you saw a 15-foot-tall wooden funerary pole towering above you, would you recognise its origins? Well, it's a unique sculpture of the Azmat people in southwest Papua. And nearly 15,000 kilometres away in an art museum in New York stands these giant poles amongst thousands of artefacts from across the Pacific Ocean. So joining us live from New York to share about the significance of these is Dr. Maya Nukul, curator for the Arts of Oceania and the Michael C. Rockefeller Wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. With that, I say kia ora e hoa and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Oh, kia ora. Morena.
Thank you so much for joining.
From New York City.
Absolutely. I know the time difference. I know it's afternoon there. So appreciate your time this morning, Maya. Look, firstly, how are you feeling since the reopening of the space and having to really see our Pacific artifacts on display?
Oh, look, I'm just so happy that we're open and the public are coming in and really enjoying it. We've had such an amazing response from, you know, visitors and colleagues in the building who are just seeing these works with fresh eyes. So it's really gratifying. You know, we've been on this project really for best part of 10 years, you know, which is, of course, museum time. Things move steadily in an institution like this, but it's been a massive undertaking. You know, it's 40,000 square foot of galleries, and the Oceania collection shares the space with two other collections from sub-Saharan Africa and the ancient Americas. So our team here in the museum has really done this incredible job of, you know, presenting these works in the kind of elevated, you know, architectural space that they deserve. So we're thrilled, yeah. And I'm just kind of landing steadily, actually, after an incredible week of opening events with our delegations. Yeah.
Well, Maya, I know that, you know, the wing that you work in is specifically named after Michael C. Rockefeller, right? I'm just wondering, can you maybe share with our listeners who may not be aware of who he is, like, yeah, who was he and why did he have such a fascination with specifically the indigenous Azmat people?
Right, yeah, well, Michael Rockefeller was a young 23-year-old recent Harvard graduate when he went out to the western part of New Guinea. He was up in the Balim, with the highlands of New Guinea with Balim peoples, actually as the sound technician and stills photographer on a film that was being made by Robert Gardner, an anthropological filmmaker. And he went there in 1961, and when they wrapped the film, he went down to the southwest coast and connected with a Dutch man who was living there, Adrian Gebrans, and joined him on these, you know, forays up into the interior, these rivers that run through that southwest coast of New Guinea, and was meeting with artists and headmen and, you know, village elders in these communities that live inland off that coast. And he was really pretty pioneering because he was really invested in the art and saw it as art. And in that era of, you know, the early 60s, we have to remember arts from our region of the world were really seen as ethnographic and kind of they were kind of locked into this kind of static, timeless kind of, you know, lens. Yes. And so for this young New Yorker to come over there, and he was a trustee of his father's museum. His father was Nelson Rockefeller, who created the museum that was transferred to the Met in 1982 and became the foundational collection that we look after and steward in this department. And so he got excited about the art and thought, wow, this is the kind of art, you know, that New Yorkers, you know, this would take the New York art world by storm. And he really saw it for its visual dynamism and its, you know, staggering beauty. And he was, more importantly, really engaged with the artists and meeting them and talking with them. He took, you know, these beautiful portraits that we have in our archive that we've made into a 6-minute in-gallery audiovisual feature, which is, you know, the portraits of artists that he took. So the works that we can display downstairs in the galleries are by named artists. You know, that's quite unusual for a collection of oceanic art. So we know the names of artists, their clan groups, you know, what their intention was with some of the iconography that they're you know, laying into these incredible sculptures and body masks, and yeah. spirit canoes. So yeah, it's a phenomenal story, and it's quite unique. And so, you know, and it's really tied to New York. So it was important for us to kind of open the galleries with this reminder of the legacy of this young man who went to this part of the world and you know, and actually lost his life there. So it's an important and special collection.
And speaking of collection, you know, I mentioned earlier, I was talking about that 15-foot-tall wooden funerary yeah. pole. I mean, it's sort of similar, you know, looking at the pictures, similar to a totem pole, I would say. I mean, right. very striking. What do they actually represent?
So, yeah, these are the biche or spirit poles, and we've displayed them in this kind of dynamic crescent shape. There are 9 of them, and as you say, 15-foot-tall. They're really like upright canoes. They're really vessels with agency that are installed to, you know, acknowledge the recently deceased in a community and to assist in the transition of the souls of those recently departed members of the community into the ancestral realm. So they are vessels that, you know, and help this crossing over of a threshold from the physical and mortal realm into the spiritual or metaphysical realm. So they were, you know, used to, you know, augur the transition, as I've said, you know, in these funerary ceremonies. But actually the ones, 4 of the ones in the set of 9 that we display were in fact installed to inaugurate a new ceremonial house in the village that Michael Rockefeller had visited. And the community actually then offered to, you know, reinstall them and reenact the ceremony so that he could document it and photograph it. And so, you know, the shift really over time in how these things are used has happened. So they were used to inaugurate, you know, this yo or the ceremonial house. And so they're really portraits of members of the community. So the figures stand on top of each other, and then you have this enormous kind of projection, which is the one of the roots of the mangrove tree. So essentially they are the height of a single, you know, mangrove tree with but they're flipped upside down. So that single projection, that wing-like chimin, as it's called,
yeah.
is one of those plank-like roots, you know, that you get at the base of a mangrove tree. So what's fascinating for me is that in this part of New Guinea, we start to see this fundamental idea that you get right across the Pacific and ends up with the story of Tane pushing up Ranginui and Papatūānuku for Māori. That is Tane as a tree kind of pushing up to split his parents, separate his parents, and propping up the sky with the roots propping up the canopy of the sky. And so what's a really incredible part of curating a collection like this is that I get to see where those ideas that are so fundamental for Māori and other Polynesian communities, you know, at the end of this line, where it starts, you know, and it starts as early as, you know, you can see it in the art that's in Papua New Guinea and in different parts of New Guinea and across. So you can really, with this collection, tell this really expansive story of Oceania and our connections across yeah. space and time.
So fascinating. And Maya, I mean, what has been the reaction, though, to those right there in New York who've been able to come through and maybe view the arts of Oceania?
Well, I mean, they're just so taken, I think, with the monumentality and the stature of these works. They are pretty unfamiliar, you know, to a lot of people. We have a really international audience who comes through these galleries in this museum. And then we have New Yorkers who come and return, you know, many times. So they love the biche poles. They feel very kind of, you know, they're pretty iconic installation for this museum. But I think what people are really taken with is this expansiveness, you know, of the imagination for oceanic art. It's really unlike anything they've ever seen. And what I tried to do with curating the new galleries was really, you know, lean into those strengths, really, these really unique materials that we use in the Pacific, the fibers, the woods, the ochres, you know, they're very different, you know, that seasonality and that kind of ephemeral nature of these things. Oftentimes, these artworks, you know, as we know, we don't, they're not really designed to last forever. You know, you use them and, you know, in ceremony or for a festival or community gathering. And then often, you know, by the next season, you know, your artists are making new ones. So that's kind of at odds with a museum, where what we do here is, you know, conservation and our scientific research departments, you know, they want to kind of fix things in time. Whereas in the Pacific, of course, things have this natural life cycle.
That's right.
So what I've been trying to do is like help people understand the materials and the kind of cyclical time that we live under and within in the Pacific. And it's not so much linear, you know, from A to Z. It's like things, you know, are seasonal and they repeat in these cycles. And so I think that's what people are taking away with them, that this real distinctiveness of Pacific art. You walk into our galleries from Greek and Roman, you know, so that department is obviously showing portraits of political leaders, you know, from the Greek and Roman civilizations that are carved in very durable materials like marble and stone. And then you kind of walk into Oceania and it's feathers and fiber and all this incredible wood and color. And I think people are really responding to that warmth, you know, of the materials. And that's helping them, you know, just get to want to know more about it. And so then they have an opportunity to really engage and understand things from a much more Indigenous-led perspective.
It's been fascinating to listen through and hear you describe all the things about our Pacific work and artwork there on the other side of the world from here in Melbourne. But look, Dr. Meyer, that is all the time that we have for this morning, but we just want to appreciate you for coming on our show this morning.
Oh, thanks, Agnes. It's great to meet you.
Absolutely.
Great
to meet you too. That, of course, is Met Curator for the Arts of Oceania, New York, Dr. Meyer Nuckel, here on Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories. Recapping, traditional and symbolic rituals to install one of the country's paramount chiefs will take place today. Te Mingiratu Te Vita Luilangemba Mara, High Chief of the Lau Islands.
This symbol maintains its position as a medium for God's salvation, how it can help enhance, promote truth, justice, peace, and a more humanistic love.
And that's Catholic Archbishop Peter Lloyd-Chong there. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but from the Kingdom of Tonga with our reporter Marion Kupo hosting. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned, because up next is your news, and coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua awhātu, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitey, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.